to be, you know, despite our past around these issues. And people like Stephen Miller, who is should not be anywhere near the executive branch of this country, should be dismissed immediately. And, you know, Donald should maybe think about surrounding himself with people who have some modicum of compassion and empathy, which he won't, which is all the more reason for him not to be in the Oval Office.
We want to thank you so much for spending this hour. Mary Trump, niece of President Donald Trump, clinical psychologist, author of Too Much and Never Enough, How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man. That does it for the show. Stay safe, wear a mask.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, last night, police and protesters again clashed at the Police Bureau's East Side precinct. Oregon is seeking rental assistance in the next coronavirus relief package, whenever that comes. And the proposal for a long-contested Longview, Washington fertilizer plant has been put on hold. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 7th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. For the second night in a row, protesters clashed with officers at the Portland Police Bureau's East Precinct. Police claim that protesters threw rocks and bottles at officers and that an officer suffered a serious injury after being struck. After midnight, an unlawful assembly was declared after cops said the crowd wanted to vandalize and burn the station. And although they did not go so far as to call the conflict an outright riot, they did order a section of Southeast 106th Avenue closed and threatened to arrest anyone who remained. The threat included members of the press. Last night's protest was reported to have been called by the Pacific Northwest Youth Liberation Front with the slogan, quote, "No cops, no prisons, total abolition." The group reportedly also organized the Wednesday night protest that was later declared a riot. Earlier in the day, the PPB had condemned the protest in advance, and Mayor Ted Wheeler had issued a warning to protesters, saying that, quote, "You are not demonstrating, you are attempting to commit murder." Speaking to the media on Wednesday, Police Chief Chuck Lavelle indicated his ongoing support for people speaking out against racism, but went on to say, quote, "Enough is enough. This is not forwarding the goals of the Black Lives Matter movement." Police reportedly did not use tear gas during last night's confrontation, although there were reports of less lethal munitions. Last month, the city of Portland set a grim record with more homicides reported in July than any other single month in the last 30 years. 15 murders in Portland were documented last month. A number of assaults, burglaries, and vandalism also showing spikes over the previous years. Police records show there were 99 shootings in July 2020 versus 28 in the same month last year. One incident in the Montevilla neighborhood, over 150 shots were fired, leaving a woman wounded and bullet holes in 8 apartment units and a number of cars. Longtime police officers specializing in gun violence expressed shock at the amount of gunfire. Portland Police Chief Chuck Lavelle told Oregon Live, quote, "As a police chief, when you see those numbers, it gives you a knot in your stomach. People are dying in your streets and you're responsible for their safety." In July, Portland's 34-member gun violence reduction team was disbanded as a result of a city audit that determined the police team had disproportionately targeted Black people. Lavelle believes that disbanding the team has limited the PPB's ability to investigate, saying, quote, "What was really lost was the follow-up piece that assisted in the investigation," end quote. Other factors possibly contributing to the uptick in the murder rate include escalations of domestic violence as a result of the pandemic lockdown and an increase in gang-related retaliation incidents. A dive into the statistics points to other potential reasons for the surge. 2 months of nightly protests demanding police accountability and an end to systemic racism, coupled, have kept the city in a constant state of unrest, tying up police officers. Summer heat, coupled with record numbers of unemployed residents stuck at home during COVID-19, could also be increasing tensions. Statistics reveal that of the 38 people injured or killed in shootings last month, 34 of the 38 were teenage boys or adult males. Oregon officials are asking Congress to beef up the next coronavirus stimulus package by adding funds to help individuals and families pay their rent. The Oregon Housing Alliance, along with similar organizations across the country, have asked for an additional $100 billion from Congress to provide for rental assistance. The current rent moratorium was intended to prevent evictions in the midst of the ongoing coronavirus pandemic and is set to expire by the end of September. There are strong indications that many Oregonians will face homelessness unless additional federal aid is secured. Renters who have taken advantage of that moratorium are still obligated to pay their past rent, and those payments are due in March of 2021. According to recent data, the Oregon Housing Alliance says 1 in 5 renters are not confident they will be able to afford their next month's rent. The ongoing COVID-19 pandemic has left many Oregonians unemployed or with reduced incomes. And those who have been receiving unemployment benefits recently saw the additional $600 provided by the CARES Act disappear. In an interview on COIN, Oregon Housing Alliance spokeswoman Allison McIntosh said, quote, "Without rent assistance, we're really going to see an increase in homelessness." She noted that many households in Oregon spend a significant amount of their income on rent. The city of Portland and Multnomah County have budgeted $29 million in local, state, and federal funds to help cover up to 3 months of back rent for an estimated 4,300 households. But state leaders are saying that more than 21,000 households in Multnomah County alone are going to be facing extreme challenges in keeping up with their rent unless sufficient assistance is included in the next stimulus package. Lawmakers in Washington, D.C. have been unable to reach a deal for the next stimulus package, and talks have ground to a halt. The democratically controlled House passed a $3 trillion package in May, but the Republican controlled Senate has been unwilling to bring that to a vote or to come together on an alternative. President Trump is threatening to take executive action if an agreement is not made soon, but it's unclear what that would look like or what authority he has to do so. In a related story, the Public News Service reports that those who were evicted as a result of inability to pay rent due to job loss may face additional challenges going forward. Mike Mullen has the story.
With the eviction moratorium and extra federal unemployment benefits expiring, people who lost their housing might try to scrape together what they can for a new place. But staff attorney Brad Peterson feels not everyone fully understood how protections under the Federal CARES Act worked. He says tenants who incurred a judgment for back rent could find it's a roadblock when trying to secure new housing.
Some of these people are going to try and apply for housing assistance in the next few months. They're going to be looking at renting from another landlord, and they're going to be told that they have to take care of this judgment.
He says that might result in requests for legal assistance if the person believes those temporary federal rules might have helped them avoid an eviction. He says it's unclear in legal circles if CARES Act eviction protections can be applied retroactively to eliminate a judgment for back rent.
That was Mike Mullen of the Public News Service. Earlier this week, Pacific Coast Fertilizer suspended its proposal to construct a $1 billion ammonia fertilizer plant at the Mint Farm Industrial Park in Longview, Washington. When completed, the plant would have converted fracked gas and produced 1,600 tons of anhydrous ammonia per day. The plan was approved by the city in 2017, and PCF had been working on an environmental impact statement for over 2 years when they decided to halt the project. The plant was long opposed by environmentalists and many Longview community members. Environmentalists pointed out that fracked gas is 90% methane, a potent greenhouse gas with climate impact nearly as bad as coal. Others cited public safety concerns over potential spills and the risk of explosion. Anhydrous ammonia is highly corrosive to the skin, eyes, and lungs. If it's released from containment, it expands rapidly and forms a heavier-than-air cloud that can linger for some time. That risk was cited in one demographic study that found that over 40% of Longview's youth live within a mile and a half of the proposed plant site. Although environmental groups are claiming victory, PCF President Scott Charpentier blamed the withdrawal of the plan on soft economic conditions caused by the coronavirus. He said that PCF still wants to build a plant in the Northwest and would consider restarting the Longview development once economic conditions improve. Would-be voters in next Tuesday's special runoff elections for Portland City Commissioner are reminded that it is too late to mail in your ballot. Those still wishing to have their vote counted are advised that they have until 8 p.m. on Tuesday, August 11th, to deliver their ballot to one of the more than 20 drop-off sites around the city. Drop-off boxes are located at a number of sites in Portland, including all library locations within city limits. Ballots delivered to libraries should be placed in the 24-hour book drop slots. Residents are reminded that the Albina Library has moved to a new location at 216 Northeast Knott Street, and that the Fairview and Troutdale libraries are not within city limits and cannot accept ballots. More information can be found by searching Portland ballot drop-off sites or going directly to multco.us/dropsites. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast. At 5:30, we're going to be hearing Counterspin. At 6, it's Let's Talk About Race, then at 7, Rising Up with Sonali. Tonight, we'll see a clear evening with an overnight low of 60 degrees. Tomorrow, morning clouds will give way to a mostly sunny and pleasant afternoon with highs in the mid-70s. On this date, in 1964, Congress overwhelmingly passed the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, allowing President Lyndon B. Johnson to use unlimited military force to prevent attacks on U.S. forces in South Vietnam. Today's quote is from Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who said, quote, "The war in Vietnam is but a symptom of a far deeper malady within the American spirit." King went on to say, quote, "The bombs in Vietnam explode at home. They destroy the hopes and possibilities for a decent America." On Monday, HBO broadcast a half-hour interview with President Donald Trump. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has these comments.
On July 28th, President Trump sat down for a one-on-one interview with Axios journalist Jonathan Swan. The interview aired on HBO this past Monday. And like Chris Wallace of Fox News, Swan was clearly not intimidated by Trump. He repeatedly pushed back against the president's misdirection or refusal to answer a question while showing that he had a better grasp of reality than Trump. The interview began with a discussion of the COVID-19 pandemic, which brought this response when Swan asked if the pandemic was under control in the U.S., before demonstrating his lack of empathy for the rest of us.
Right now, I think it's under control. I'll tell you what.
How? 1,000 Americans are dying a day.
They are dying. That's true. And you it is what it is. But that doesn't mean we aren't doing everything we can. It's under control as much as you can control it. This is a horrible plague that beset us.
You really think this is as much as we can control?
He then asked about Trump's decision to hold a rally in Tulsa, and the president used the opportunity to boast about his numbers.
We had a 19,000-seat stadium. First of all, we had 12,000 people, not 6,000, which you reported and other people reported. The other thing we had that nobody wants to talk about, so Fox broadcast it. It was the highest rating in the history of Fox television Saturday night.
1,000 Americans are dying a day.
They are dying. That's true. And it is what it is.
But this, of course, is old news. Trump's failure to take control or responsibility when the virus hit is well documented. Next, Swan touched on the federal presence in Portland.
Let's move to Portland. I'm sure you've seen the disturbing footage of people in fatigues beating the Navy veteran.
No.
Well,
here you go.
It's there.
The fake news.
It's not fake news. It's on video.
For
pepper spraying him.
59 days, these people were anarchists and agitators and some protesters, but these were anarchists.
Okay.
These people were beating the hell out of the city.
But perhaps the most disturbing part of the interview came near the end as Swan transitioned from Portland to the Black Lives Matter movement and police violence.
Turning to the rest of the country, we haven't seen protests like this since the 60s. I mean, we're seeing...
These are Democrats.
Well, just if I can finish my question.
And they're doing it for political reasons.
You said you've done so much for African Americans.
I have.
But there are Americans...
Criminal justice reform, opportunity.
But let me finish. There are Americans out in the streets asking for change. Mr. President, have you ever met with a Black Lives Matter activist to hear them out, hear their arguments?
Well, Black Lives Matter started off to me very badly because it was...
Did you ever meet with one?
Pigs in a blanket, burn them like bacon. That was the first time I ever heard of black. That was 3-4 years ago.
Uh-huh. Would you meet with a Black Lives Matter activist?
I would, but I think right now when they paint the sign, nobody's asked for a meeting. Right? Nobody's ever asked me for a meeting.
Do you believe, though, Mr. President, that many police treat black people differently from white people?
Well, I hope not. I hope not.
I'm talking about, what does systemic racism mean to you?
I hope the answer to that question is no. Does anybody really answer that question accurately?
But what about not hope? What about analysis? What's your cold-hearted view of
it? I have seen where there is a difference, and I don't want there to be a difference. But with that being said...
Why do you think black men are 2.5 times...
white people...
I know, but why do you think black men...
In a larger number,
in quantity,
police have killed white people.
But why do you think black men are 2.5 times more likely to be killed by police than white men?
That I don't know, but
I don't like it. But you must have thought
about
it.
I don't know why, but I don't like it. I do know this.
Does it speak to something systemic?
Police have killed many white people also.
But proportionally, what does it speak to?
It speaks to something, if that's the number, you're telling
me
a number. Okay, if that's the number, it speaks to something that to me is unacceptable.
And what do you do about it then?
Well, I think we've already done a lot
of
things.
But you haven't, it still exists.
Let me just tell you. I did more for the black community than anybody with the possible exception of Abraham Lincoln.
These are just a few of the lowlights during a half-hour interview in which Trump also took the opportunity to shout out his support for accused child sex trafficker Ghislaine Maxwell, attacked mail-in voting as a recipe for corruption, confirmed that he has never spoken to Vladimir Putin about charges that Russia paid the Taliban a bounty for killing American troops in Afghanistan, and finished it off by dissing the legacy of civil rights icon John Lewis because Lewis refused to attend Trump's inauguration. It was an appalling display by a corrupt and ignorant autocrat. And if you have the stomach for it, the entire video can be viewed on YouTube. Just Google Axios Trump interview to see the entire 37 minutes. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
The Commission on Presidential Debates has rejected the Trump campaign's request for a fourth debate, and Hawaii has a primary tomorrow, but there are only 8 vote service centers. With more on that story and others, we go to Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
There seems to be be some frustration on the Trump campaign part of, you know, well, Joe Biden is not out there campaigning, and it seemed like every week his poll numbers get a little better.
University of Missouri professor Mitchell McKinney explains why he thinks the Trump campaign asked for another debate.
Why did he come around and change complete, you know, reversal from, you know, I'm saying I'm not going to debate or may not debate to I want more debate? Well, look who's leading.
The Commission on Presidential Debates denied their request. Ohio will hold the first one. Polls there show a tight race between Trump and Biden. And in Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, a recent survey from Focus on Rural America indicates problems for the president as well, says spokesman Jeff Link.
When we said, who do you think would do a better job for people living in small towns in rural America? In 2016, this would not have been a close call. It would have been Trump over Clinton. But in these four battleground states, they choose Biden over Trump, 51 to 35.
The president was in Ohio yesterday to tour a Whirlpool plant and sign an executive order requiring the government to buy certain drugs from American companies. Republican Governor Mike DeWine tested positive for COVID-19 in his presidential pre-visit screen. While Tennesseans could all vote absentee in yesterday's primary, they won't be able to this November. Their state Supreme Court ruled this week that fear of contracting COVID is not a valid excuse. Hawaii's primary is tomorrow, its first with vote by mail. But Sandy Ma with Common Cause says the pandemic has created yet another problem.
Given our dependence on tourism and the economy has shut down around tourism, we are really concerned about people having to move from their homes because they're unable to pay their rent or their mortgages and having their ballot follow them.
Ma hopes Hawaii will make more places for people to vote in person. Currently, there are only 8 locations.
We want to make sure vote by mail is coupled with enough polling centers so that it supports people who are disabled, people who need language assistance, translation assistance, or people who just want to vote in person.
New York's Attorney General Letitia James filed a lawsuit yesterday seeking to dissolve the National Rifle Association, registered in New York, for, quote, fraud and misconduct, unquote. The influential lobbying group spent millions on the president's 2016 campaign. The New York lawsuit alleges the NRA and 4 of its top executives diverted millions away from the group's stated mission and into its officials' pockets. In response, Trump suggested the NRA should move to Texas. Answering reporters' questions, James made the legal basis clear.
This has nothing to do with my personal opinion with regards to gun violence. This has to do with the fact that 4 individual defendants and the NRA as a corporation, unfortunately, did not follow not-for-profit law in the state of New York. And as a result of that, they should be held accountable.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
A Chippewa tribe in North Dakota has recognized same-sex marriage after a tribal council vote. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians in North Dakota will recognize same-sex marriage after a tribal council vote Thursday. The council approved an amendment to broaden the definition of marriage. KFYR reports the vote was 6-2. Members of the LGBTQ community held a rally prior to the vote. The tribe is reportedly the first tribe in the state to formally recognize same-sex marriage. The Crow tribe in Montana will lock down for 14 days due to COVID-19. Chairman A.J. Not Afraid issued the order Thursday to help prevent the spread of the virus. In a press release, Not Afraid said previous stay-at-home orders were not followed properly, pointing to an increase of positive COVID-19 cases. A daily curfew from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. will be implemented and checkpoints are being established. At this time, students will remain at home until the tribal administration determines it's safe to return to school. The reservation has one hospital it shares with the Northern Cheyenne tribe. There are limited beds and ventilators. According to the tribe, Bighorn County, which includes the Crow Reservation, confirmed nearly 200 positive cases this week and 4 deaths due to COVID-19. The stay-at-home order for the Crow tribe is extended through the end of August. The Mescalero Apache tribe in New Mexico is lifting its 14-day lockdown order Friday at noon. The tribe closed the reservation 2 weeks ago after positive COVID-19 cases nearly doubled among residents in a matter of days. In a video message to tribal citizens, President Gabe Aguilar thanked people for following the order and urged them to continue to take precautions.
Wear your mask, wash your hands. Think about it, you're taking care of everyone. Us as a tribe, we're making sure everybody's okay. but we can't let our guard down. No matter what you're doing, protect yourself, protect your family.
The tribe last week provided food and supplies to residents, and this week stimulus checks were sent out. The tribe is urging residents not to travel out of state, and checkpoints are set up. Schools will not start until after Labor Day. The tribe has also set up isolation units for those who need to be quarantined. This week, the tribe reported 59 positive COVID-19 cases on the reservation. The Navajo Nation is also modifying its COVID-19 emergency orders. Daily curfews will begin at 9 p.m. to 5 a.m., and the weekend lockdowns will now be 32 hours starting Saturday nights to Monday mornings. The tribe began 57-hour weekend curfews on Easter to address high numbers of COVID-19, which have since flattened. Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez, in a virtual town hall Thursday night, explained the modified lockdowns are intended to give people time to prepare for the winter by gathering firewood, supplies, food, and other items.
Now's the time for all of us to begin to prepare for the winter. Experts have said that there may possibly be a second surge in the winter, and we got to prepare for that. So what I mean by preparing, we haul wood, we get supplies to our family members, and really just starting to stock up, because there's so much uncertainty right now before us. And when we begin to prepare, we don't have to run around at the last minute.
Nez says the tribe's also preparing for the upcoming flu season and is encouraging Navajo citizens to continue to take COVID-19 precautions. As of Thursday, Navajo Health Departments reported there were 9,223 positive cases of COVID-19, more than 6,000 recoveries, and 468 deaths. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
What happens when livestock escapes during major storms? In Sarasota, Florida, a trained team responds. For more on that, here's Dr. Anthony Lizowitz with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When there's a severe storm in the forecast, lots of people worry about flooding and power outages. Far fewer think about cows roaming loose on the highway.
Fences go down, and so things like cattle, horses, goats, pigs, livestock, they get out. And that can cause, obviously, a hazard to those animals, but also to humans, in that they often end up wandering in the roads, including onto the interstate.
Sarah Bostick is an extension agent in Sarasota County, Florida, and is part of the Sarasota Agricultural Recovery Group, a team of ranchers, emergency responders, and volunteers. They're armed with ham radios and trained to help out with all kinds of agricultural emergencies, from rescuing escaped livestock to delivering fuel to a generator that powers irrigation at a plant nursery.
We know exactly where in the county we will probably need to respond first and go check on first. We know where is most likely to flood first. We know where there's animals, where there's crops, where there's greenhouses, where there's orchards.
So as extreme weather grows more common, they're prepared to help minimize the harm to farms, ranches, and animals. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News for Friday, August 7th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Ray Bodwell, and Althea Billings. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Mike Moen, Antonia Gonzalez, and Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programming, including the evening news, is made possible by support from our listeners. If you would like to support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stick around. Up next, we'll be hearing Counterspin.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to newsdirector, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, two Georgia teens were reportedly suspended for posting a photo of their recent